Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. After President Trump's freewheeling campaign event in Phoenix last night, paid for by his campaign committee, former Director of National Intelligence James Clapper told CNN he found it disturbing.
I really question his fitness to be in this office. And I also am beginning to wonder about his motivation for it. Maybe he is looking for a way out.
Of the 75-minute speech last night, 16 was spent on a retelling of how the president responded to the white supremacist demonstrations in Charlottesville. Here's what he said last night.
Really fast, here's what I said on Saturday. We're closely following the terrible events unfolding in Charlottesville, Virginia. This is me speaking. We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence. That's me speaking on Saturday.
But here's what he actually said last Saturday.
We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides. On many sides.
Let's bring in Jimmy Jenkins with KJZZ. And Jimmy, the president left out the words that troubled people, that many sides were responsible for Charlottesville. But today, conservative voice Laura Ingraham says Trump should hold a rally every week. It was that effective. What's the view on the ground there?
Well, it certainly was effective for his base. A lot of people were lining up early yesterday morning to see the president. I talked to the former chair of the Arizona Republican Party, Robert Graham, and he said, you know, get ready because this is just kind of like the new normal for politics. I guess we've been used to the perpetual cycle, but he said that, you know, this is important, especially for areas like Arizona, for the president to come. And that's one of the main things that I think the audience really responded to is he started off the speech by saying, recalling the times when he came here in 2015, one of the first places in the country where a lot of people showed up, a big groundswell of support. So the crowd really reacted positively to that.
Well, some of the biggest applause lines were when he attacked the media. He said he truly believed the press doesn't like our country and that they're trying to take away our history and our heritage. Meeting the Confederate statues, all of which we know they weren't put up during the Civil War, but were put up from the late 1800s to the 1900s to protest civil rights. Did anybody question that?
Well, you know, it wasn't exactly. I think a lot of us wanted to, maybe in the press, wanted to speak up and say something. But as we always do, we just kept recording. I know a lot of our colleagues in TV kept rolling for the entire speech. So the president says that the media takes him out of context, but I believe that our organization and everyone else there gave him ample time to express his dislike of us.
Well, there was a lot of that. The president again hinted he might pardon former Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who was convicted of criminal contempt in July for refusing to end his racial profiling. The president asked the crowd, you know, what do you think of him? And he asked the crowd, it took like a poll. What's your sense? Do you think he's going to do this?
We do. There were some reports even this morning that the White House is preparing to take action. But last night he told us, I think he said, quote, Sheriff Joe doesn't have anything to worry about. But he said, I'm not going to do it tonight because I don't want to cause any unrest or controversy. But Robin, this is fascinating because, you know, Trump's own Department of Justice, federal prosecutors spent a lot of time and resources successfully prosecuting this case, not just showing that Arpaio had disobeyed a federal judge's order, but that he and his top level command staff did so knowingly for political gain. So for the executive now to come out and say that this pardon is coming, obviously it threw a lot of people for a loop.
Okay. Well, the president also went after Arizona's U.S. Senators, Jeff Flake, John McCain, both Republicans, both critics. McCain, he went after for ultimately not voting to repeal Obamacare. Let's listen.
No, I won't vote. One vote away, I will not mention any names. Very presidential, isn't it? Very presidential. And nobody wants me to talk about your other senator, who's weak on borders, weak on crime. So I won't talk about him.
Jimmy Jenkins, how is this going over with Republicans there as he tears away in the end there at Jeff Flake, who's up for re-election, And the candidate that the president is supporting, it said, may not be a Democrat.
That's right. And he couldn't help himself because just this morning he tweeted, okay, it was Flake that I was talking about, you know, the person that's weak.
As if we did not know.
that's right. Yeah. But I think that the president actually last night must have been listening to people because he kept telling the crowd, they're telling me not to say any names. You know, they're asking me not to say any names. So I think he's getting a lot of pressure from his own party to, you know, not go after these senators like this in this public setting, but he clearly can't help himself. And it does fire up the base here. I mean, there are a lot of the people that support the president are critics of especially Senator McCain. So I think he knew that that was red meat for the crowd.
Yeah. Just tell us briefly what happened afterwards. We saw that there was tear gas, flashbang grenades. What happened?
That's right. The Phoenix police did a good job of keeping everyone separate, but just by the nature of these events, they always kind of tend to go south at the end as everyone's going home. Mm-hmm. And so as the crowd was leaving the convention center, they did come into contact with some protesters. There were a few skirmishes, then another incident where police say things were thrown at them, so they responded with pepper projectiles and spray and flashbangs, four arrests, no major injuries, though a lot of people actually had to go to the hospital for heat exhaustion. But luckily, that was the extent of it.
Well, four arrests, thousands of people. Jimmy Jenkins, KJZZ in Phoenix. Thank you.
Vice President Mike Pence is in Doral, Florida today, home to the largest Venezuelan immigrant community in the U.S. For years now, Venezuelans have been emigrating to the United States to escape their country's fiscal crisis and violent crime, the worst on the continent. But with President Nicolas Maduro assuming near dictatorial powers this summer, the Venezuelan expat community is now bracing for a wave of political exiles. Tim Padgett from WLRN in Miami reports.
Gustavo Marcano is the mayor of the eastern Venezuelan city of Lechería. Like most places in Venezuela, Lechería has been the site of angry government protests as the country's economy collapses and as its socialist government morphs into what critics call a dictatorship. But because Marcano is an opposition mayor, that government recently ordered his arrest for not stopping the protest in his city. In fact, it summarily sentenced Marcano to 15 months in prison. And he says it got worse. My family and I received death threats by phone and text, Marcano says. Pro-government thugs even picketed my house and harassed my kids. So Marcano, his wife, and two young boys took a clandestine route out of Venezuela. They arrived this month in Doral, Florida, just west of Miami.
La dictadura es de tal calaña.
Venezuela's regime is a bona fide dictatorship now, Marcano told me, and it will commit any abuse to make sure it stays in power forever. More than 100 people have been killed in the anti-government protests this year. Polls show fewer than 1 in 5 Venezuelans now supports President Nicolas Maduro. But Maduro consolidated power recently by creating a new National Assembly, a move constitutional experts call illegal, filled with his supporters. Backed by the military, the new assembly wants to jail Maduro's political opponents. So far, it has 20 opposition mayors and other officials on its list. Human rights watchdog Amnesty International says the government is taking repression to a frightening new level. Venezuelan exiles see that, too.
The only law in Venezuela is 20 people that form this regime and their shock troops.
Janet Gonzalez left Venezuela 15 years ago when those socialist shock troops, street gangs called colectivos, bullied her family out of the country for opposing Maduro's late predecessor, Hugo Chavez. In 2008, after settling in Florida, she co-founded the group Politically Persecuted Venezuelans in Exile, or VPEX. Most recent Venezuelan immigrants to South Florida came to flee the economic crisis and violent crime. But Gonzalez says VPEX is now bracing for a wave of political exiles.
Right now, the persecution is growing day by day. They remove the mask.
Meaning, she says, Venezuela's new regime has removed any pretense of tolerating dissent. Critics say that also means it has cast away any qualms about ratcheting up brutality. Take the case of Willy Arteaga. He's a 23-year-old musician who's become famous for playing his violin during street demonstrations, even amid tear gas. That's Arteaga playing during a protest in Caracas just before he visited Miami as an ambassador for Venezuela's opposition in June. Late last month, the National Guard arrested him and, according to those who visited him in jail, severely beat him. Gabriela Ramirez is a Venezuelan human rights attorney involved in Arteaga's case.
Que él es un símbolo de una lucha pacífica.
Willie symbolizes peaceful protest, and the regime wants to eradicate that, Ramirez said from Caracas. They want the world to think the opposition is only violent terrorists.
It's almost like you have X-ray vision. It's like, oh my goodness, again.
Milly Herrera is a Cuban-born Venezuelan-American. She watched her late father oppose the socialist governments in Cuba and Venezuela. And she says her dad taught her to know when a country has become a police state, when opposition leaders will be hunted down and flee into exile. In Venezuela, she says, that's now.
It always happens in these quote-unquote revolutions. They choose who they persecute and who they jail because that is strategic to set an example and fear.
Herrera was part of an expat group that met this month with Florida Senator Bill Nelson to discuss the Venezuelan emergency. A few days later, Miami-Dade County commissioners urged President Trump to grant Venezuelan exiles temporary protected status here in the U.S. For Here and Now, I'm Tim Padgett in Miami.
Summer's almost over, but fishing tournament season is about to begin, so we thought we'd bring you an epic tale from last summer on Martha's Vineyard. It's like a trumpet call summoning the faithful. It's the sound of tires being deflated on an old wagon loaded with fishing equipment at South Beach on Martha's Vineyard off the coast of New England. You deflate the tires, our guide tells us, so you're not the jerk who gets stuck or ruts up the sand. And you go off-road, with a permit, of course, because you want to get to the best surf casting possible. Our guide is Paul Schultz. Everyone here knows him.
Hi, Beverly. Hi, Randy.
We're riding the beach on our right, the dunes on our left. Oh, it's beautiful. Paul is a legendary angler featured in the definitive book Reading the Water by Robert Post. Last year, he offered to take me out to a part of the island beachgoers don't get to see and to share some tips on surf casting, that's fishing the ocean from the shore. But as you'll hear, fishing is not just about fishing. For instance, very often it's about stories about fishing, and Paul's is a whopper. It's about a tuna.
It sounds like, you know, Arlo Guthrie's Alice's Restaurant. It's a tale.
What happened is I was coming fishing. It was, middle of November, and I saw the fish laying on the side, on the beach.
900 pounds.
Yeah, and I said, you know, my father would like to see something like that. He was still alive.
So Paul's dad and then some friends began the work of getting the 900-pound, still-fresh tuna off the beach. It could feed the whole island. But this work took hours, ropes, pickup trucks, a come-along, those little hand winches. Finally, they set off for town, where word had spread.
There was a guy that was he was sitting on Main Street having a beer, and we pulled up alongside. He gets on the CB, he says, have you seen Paul Schultz and Ralph Case? 1 o'clock, and they had hooked up to a fish at Waste Creek, and they were fighting this fish. And this guy said, well, they just got in. You ought to see it. They're on their way to Laurie's Fish Market to weigh it in. So nobody in their right mind ever thought they were going to see a 16-foot, 900-pound tuna fish in the back of a pickup truck. So we got up there, and there's got to be 20 cars up there waiting for us. And the police gave us an escort straight up Main Street against the traffic at 2 o'clock in the morning, and we took it to the fish market. And so that's what got us in trouble.
Long story short, they were accused of the Great Tuna Massacre. A fishmonger brought the dressed fish to Boston to sell, but the tuna quota had been reached. Government officials launched an investigation to see if the fish had been caught illegally off a boat. A great hue and cry rose up. The fishermen were grilled. The fish sat in a freezer for weeks.
Like I say, I told Coop the other day, I said, if I find another tuna fish, you guys can have it. I get a note, caught by world-famous angler Paul Schultz, too big to take home, enjoy. Any luck?
Hey, how you doing? We haven't seen anything here today. It's been slow.
Okay, where were we? Oh, yes, driving down stretches of mostly deserted beach, passing the infrequent fishermen, all of them spot Paul and bring him fresh intel.
Hi, Mark.
How are you?
Good. How you doing?
Pretty good.
Anything out there?
A little bit. East Beach. Keith is doing pretty well on East Beach, picking it up as he walks.
Okay.
Talk to you later.
All righty, Mark.
In the distance, we see a seam of foam from the beach out to sea. This is two sides of the ocean crashing into each other as well as the shore.
It's a riptide up here. That's where the two waters come together. See, if it's rising, the tide's going to be going right to left, and the waves will be coming left to right. And if it's falling, the water will be going left to right, and the waves will be going right to left. And that they meet, and that's the riptide.
Oh, man, I hate riptides.
Well, we're not going to go in.
Yeah. And what does the riptide do for fish?
It brings them in. Here's a bait. It'll get in there.
So the riptide brings the bait in, and then the fish follow the bait?
Yep.
What's the bait out here?
This is silver sides and stuff. There's some squid around, too.
So, what's your lure?
It's a piece of metal. It's a minnow, a little minnow. So, stand on my left.
Yeah.
When you cast, you just release. And if you cast out and you're right-handed, if it goes off to the right, you let it go too soon. If it goes off to the left, you held it too long. You don't have to make a lot of movement. Just come back, flick your wrist, and there it goes.
What's the longest you've stood in one spot casting?
7 or 8 hours. But you don't stand on one spot, you move. So I always tell people, take 5 or 6 casts, 10 casts, then move a few paces one way or the other. You come to the end of the sandbar, and that's where the fish are, at the in the end of the sandbar. So.
But still, 7 or 8 hours.
Yeah.
What are you thinking about?
I'm just fishing. All right, we're going to go get a key to the lighthouse.
Okay.
Well, that's the other thing about fishing. It's often about exploring. In this case, Chappaquiddick, which curls like a flexed arm around the eastern end of Martha's Vineyard. We climb the beautiful, refurbished Edgartown Lighthouse. We saw the fenced-off beach area, once used for test bomb runs during World War II. Now, because of beach erosion, bombs are surfacing and being carefully harvested by Army officials.
So this is where they're finding these World War II bombs. Danger, do not enter, unexploded ordnance.
Is that the Chappie Bridge?
Yep. Yeah, that's it. They put rails on it now.
We drove over the thin wooden bridge that Senator Ted Kennedy drove off in 1969, his passenger, Mary Jo Kopechne, drowning. It prompts another memory for Paul.
When they had the 40th anniversary in 09... a television crew said, well, what do you think? What happened to you when you, July 18th of 69, when you woke up and you heard about the Kennedy accident? I said the same thing that I thought of the rest of the year. I said, what's that? Keeping my men alive. I was a squad leader in Vietnam. Oh, I don't want to talk to you. I said, I thought about my guys.
So, fishing is also about restoration. During our drive, Paul says hi to other Vietnam-era vets, and he welcomes younger veterans from the Wounded Warrior Program when they arrive on the island. Paul gets them out to fish.
You were telling me you had some effective Agent Orange on your hands? Or
brachial neuropathy, killed all the nerves in my hand.
How do you fish?
I reel with that hand.
Is there any connection between, you know, coming back from Vietnam and finding something in fishing?
Well, it's easy. It relaxes me. You know, seeing all my friends. You know something? There'd be many a nights I'd be out there fishing with somebody and we'd be on the beach and I'd say, uh-oh, there's somebody down here. Come down 100 yards, there was two guys fishing. I had the sense.
You mean you had the sense from being in Vietnam?
The sense that somebody was there.
Yeah.
Hey, Janet.
And fishing is fellowship. We run into another famed female angler, Janet Messineo.
Oh! What are you doing, Impia?
So, tell me what I should know about surf casting.
Just to keep your line in the water. You know how to catch a fish? The way you catch a fish is you go fishing. You know, put your line in the water. Fish.
So, we do. We head back to the rip, where the word is blues are being pulled out. And as we cast, one almost is.
Oh, there's a fish. There's a fish on.
Oh, yeah, he's got one.
Oh, he lost it.
Lost it.
Should have walked it down instead of fighting it right there against the tide. He should have walked down this way. You just say, fish on, and the guy will stop casting, and you walk by where he is, and then he'll go on that side of you.
That will be our last lesson for today. Walk a hooked fish down to calmer waters. Other anglers will let you pass.
I think I signed your book for you.
As we head back to town, Paul cites Brad Holly, whose wife once had Paul sign a copy of the now out-of-print book Reading the Water, which features Paul, as a gift for Brad. I asked Brad, what is it about Paul's fishing that's won him such respect?
Well, I mean, I think it's legendary. I mean, you really have to read the book. It's the Bible, if you will, of Martha's Vineyard fishing. And if he hasn't told you the story about the tuna, I'm sure...
We heard the story about the tuna.
Well, there you go. That in and of itself is legendary right there. But you know, the other thing that, you know, we've never met, but I have his cell phone number. He's offered to take me fishing and all this other kind of stuff. So I think that that's as much, I think that says as much about him as just about his fishing prowess.
His generosity. Exactly. Yes.
Is a day in which you don't get any fish still a good fishing day?
Oh, yeah. A bad day of fishing beats a good day at work.
Well, what am I going to cook?
We'll go to the fish market.
Because, again, fishing is not necessarily about catching a fish.
Right there.
It is. It is a
oyster catcher
right there. Oh, yeah. I wish my phone wasn't dead.
Two of them.
Yep. Orange bills, long orange bills, black backs, white bellies.
Yep.
Not one fish, but lots of memories. Our surf casting trip with Paul Schultz on the beaches of Martha's Vineyard from last year. For pictures, go to herenow.org.
About 1 in 10 adults are at risk of developing Alzheimer's by age 65, and if you carry a specific version of a gene, an allele called APOE4, that risk increases dramatically. A group of people who have had genetic testing and have learned that they carry a copy or two of this gene are trying to prevent or at least delay the disease, which has no cure. Meghana Keshavan covers biotech for our partners at STAT, and she joins us now. And first of all, tell us, for these people who have this allele that increases their risk of developing Alzheimer's, what are they doing with that information?
There's not a whole lot you can do with that information. Tests like 23andMe, they kind of open up this Pandora's box of genetic data that you can get. And once you have it, it's a question mark. What do you do? So some people just sort of live with that information, and other people are trying to be proactive and find ways to stave off their Alzheimer's disease with diet and exercise mostly.
Yeah, so I was going to ask you how, because there's no, you know, there's no cure for it. There are a variety of medicines to deal with symptoms of Alzheimer's, but you can't stop it, though.
No, but some people are trying. There is evidence, you know, that the Mediterranean diet works. People get recommended that. Also, Alzheimer's has been linked to diabetes and high cholesterol. So, you know, managing those things are really important. But some people have kind of gone beyond that. Like, one thing people are doing is a ketogenic diet, which is kind of similar to Atkins, the Atkins diet, in that people don't consume many carbohydrates and mostly fats. So that retrains the body to burn fat instead of glucose to create energy. And that might maybe protect the brain, but it's very speculative. It is something they're trying to do, though. And they're also trying to fast. You know, go for a couple days without eating a whole lot and, again, try and trick that body into burning bad fats, because Alzheimer's has been linked with a buildup of bad proteins and bad fats. So there is a thought.
You know, I have a question, though, about this, because, I mean, for the things that you're describing that people are trying, it doesn't sound like there's any bad side or downside to it, right? Because you're talking about not smoking, exercising more, eating healthier. So what's the problem here?
There is no problem. Yeah. It's actually fine. It's just that there's no conclusive evidence that it works. There's some really interesting findings that suggest it may work. Like, for instance, there's something called the Nigerian paradox, where people in Nigeria carry this APOE4 allele at pretty high rates, and they don't generally develop much Alzheimer's disease. And a thought is that because they have active lifestyles and have a certain diet that's low in carb and, you know, high in good proteins and good fats and things like that, they are able to not get dementia. So people are trying.
Yeah, so it's just that there's no hard data that it works to stave off Alzheimer's. But what about the idea of sort of brain training? It's all the rage. Crosswords, you know, online brain games, things to keep, you know, the actual neural network in your head healthy.
It's, again, one of those largely unproven but still potentially helpful things. I hate to keep repeating myself. The problem is that, you know, a lot of these Alzheimer's trials are funded by pharmaceutical companies that do want to create a drug at the end of the day. And outside of that, there isn't too much that goes towards some of the more lifestyle adaptations that you could make, because there's just no money in it. So until better research is out, we just have to say it's certainly not going to hurt.
Yeah. There's this very touching quote, though, from someone you spoke to, Lacey, who says that she feels motivated to save every brain cell she can, even if it's a long shot. Well, Meghna Keshavan covers biotech for our partners at STAT. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's here and now. And now a warning. We have a grim story from Denmark. Today, Danish police confirmed that an armless, legless, headless torso found in Copenhagen earlier this week is that of a missing 30-year-old Swedish freelance journalist named Kim Wall. She was last seen nearly 2 weeks ago getting into the homemade submarine of Danish inventor and would-be rocket pilot Peter Madsen. He originally told police he dropped Wall off on an island, later changed that to something happened on board and he buried her at sea. His lawyer says an accident did happen. The submarine later sank. Madsen was rescued swimming away, and he's been charged with manslaughter. Sissel Overgaard is a reporter in Billund, Denmark. Sissel, what a grim finding. But in addition to confirming that this is Kim Wall's torso, were investigators able to learn any more about how she died?
Not really. What we learned today that was new on top of the DNA match that they said they received by comparing DNA from the torso and some personal items of Kim Wall and actually some blood that they found on the submarine. The other somewhat surprising thing that we learned was that there was actually metal attached to the body, presumably to help hold it underwater.
Oh. Her mother described her as a journalist who gave voice to the weak, vulnerable, and marginalized people. A friend that was with her at Columbia University wrote on the International Women's Media Foundation. I followed her work from an in-depth look at voodoo in Haiti, tourism in North Korea. She went to North Korea. Idi Amin's legacy in Uganda. How shocking that this was in Denmark. What are people in Denmark saying?
Well, it is shocking. I think, you know, Denmark might have this reputation that's grown a bit out of some of the recent TV dramas, the Nordic noir and all those, you know, The Bridge and all of these things. But this isn't a normal occurrence in Denmark by any stretch. And so, of course, people have been watching with great suspense, and the story peaked at the beginning when the submarine initially went missing, and then Wall went missing, and then it was a little quiet for about a week, and now all of a sudden in the last few days it's really blown up again as all these new revelations have come out. And it's definitely water cooler discussion, and people are all speculating on what could possibly have been the motive, what could possibly have happened. And it's not looking good for Madsen at this point. Most people would, I think, agree.
Well, in fact, people are coming forward and saying, yes, he was dedicated to his work, you know, fierce about his projects, an inventor. He was looking for crowdsourcing for some of the ideas that he had, but he had a terrible temper.
Right. And I think that you could describe him as monofocused. He obviously had burned a lot of people and business partners along the way. And I guess anyone who could conceive of getting himself into space, you'd have to be a little bit crazy in order to convince people that that was possible. And somehow he was able to do that. So at the same time that you hear from former friends that don't even really want to talk about him much anymore, he did have a fair number of supporters. And in fact, there was a Facebook group that was dedicated to the supporters of Rocket Madsen, which, probably not coincidentally, I can see has been shut down just within the last day.
Well, and as you said, there's fascination because this is like a real life Nordic noir. But we hear that there is sadness. And is there also fear, or do people think that this is an isolated incident?
At the press conference this morning, the police addressed just that. And of course, people are wondering, have you been looking at old cases to see if there might be any other connections here? They brought up the case from 1986, I believe it was, of a torso of a Japanese tourist that was found in Denmark. That obviously is so old at this point. You know, Peter Messen was 46 years old, so that would have been made him obviously very young. So, but they are looking at old cases. But as far as we know, thus far, there isn't any indication that this was anything more widespread than this one incident.
One terrible incident. Sissel Overgaard, a reporter in Billund, Denmark, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Well, switching gears, there's new leadership and direction at the historic LA Times newspaper. The publisher and editor-in-chief is out. There's a newsroom struggling with morale after the reporting on a scandal at the University of Southern California. On Monday, Ross Levinson was announced as the paper's new CEO and publisher. He previously served as interim CEO for Yahoo and president of Fox Interactive Media. For more on the shakeup, as well as the reemergence of Steve Bannon at Breitbart, let's bring in NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. David, tell us more about what's going on at the Times, the LA Times, and what it means.
Well, so I've been reporting a bit on this in the last couple of days, and Variety reported some of this yesterday as well. But it's fascinating the way in which this absolutely stellar, gem-like reporting that the LA Times has done on the University of Southern California, a big scandal there, actually ended in the ouster of basically the top cadre of leadership at the paper. Hmm. Essentially, the lead reporter was so convinced that editors had sat on this story in one way or another for over a year that he filed a complaint. And that complaint led to review by human resources, and from what other people within the LA Times newsroom have also told me, that also opened the floodgates to a series of other complaints about morale, about leadership, about communication, about lack of trust by Devon Maharaj, who was serving in the role of publisher and editor-in-chief, and also with some of his top editors there. So Tronc pulled the trigger.
And Tronc's the parent company. Yeah.
That's right. It stands for Tribune Online Content. They own the newspapers that used to belong to the Tribune Company. And they said essentially, we're going to get rid of all you guys. We're going to bring in new leadership and separate the roles of publisher and editor in such a way that there are clear lines there.
Why? Had they sat on the story? You say the complaint was that they had.
You know, the allegation was such that there was a conflict of interest, and people read into the idea the fact that there is a partnership between the LA Times and the University of Southern California, USC, for its huge annual festival of books. And they were cleared of that conflict of interest. That was seen not to weigh into it. There is the claim from senior editors has been made privately in the newsroom that the story wasn't ready to publish. And indeed, in ensuing months, they were able to get a ton of more information. They were able to get a key woman who basically overdosed, a young woman who overdosed in the hotel room with the then medical dean of USC in order to be able to they were able to get her on the record to talk about it in a way that really changed the nature and thrust of the story. But they had a lot of reporting on hand in the beginning realm. So there's some controversy of whether or not it was ready to publish. That's a judgment call. That's what journalism often amounts to.
Well, fascinating journalism story. And there's another one. Steve Bannon has returned to Breitbart. He once called it a platform for what he called the alt-right, which are nationalists, white supremacists. And he went right to work. He said, this is war. Who's he at war with? Because he did blast President Trump after the president's speech Monday on the strategy in Afghanistan. Or Breitbart did. Yeah.
Breitbart did. What Bannon has said in interviews in his bombastic way, and what has been supported in the ensuing few days since he's been back in the saddle, about 5 days, is that they're going to go out to war with those inside the Trump administration and on Capitol Hill who they see as insufficiently devoted to the president's purest and truest self. And that's the Breitbart and Bannon version of him, the one that wants to be more nationalist, the one that wants to pull back from commitments abroad. Steve Bannon had supported the idea of essentially outsourcing what we do in Afghanistan to you could call them mercenaries, to contractors like those led by Eric Prince, who had been the founder of controversially of Blackwater. Steve Bannon has been strongly supportive of what Donald Trump has said, for example, after Charlottesville, not in his more presidential remarks, but in saying basically there are problems with all sides and seemingly equating anti-racist protesters with the white supremacists who occasioned their presence down there in Charlottesville. You know, obviously we recall a young woman died, many others injured when somebody seemingly allied with the white supremacist protesters plowed into a group of folks while driving a car, quite intentionally. So Steve Bannon is basically trying to endorse that. You've seen Breitbart go after Paul Ryan. You've seen Breitbart go after Jared Kushner. You've seen Breitbart go after people who they see as not supporting the purest version of Trump.
Well, and you now have an email prankster who was able to get emails from Breitbart staff talking about getting rid of President Trump's, as in the White House, getting rid of President Trump's daughter, Ivanka, and her husband, Jared Kushner, pushing them out. An embarrassing moment for Breitbart there. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, taking a look at Steve Bannon returning to Breitbart, maybe going to television. We'll talk more about that another day, that Steve Bannon might want a television arm as well. David, thank you.
You bet.
In 1960, a well-known literature professor at Smith College in Northampton, Massachusetts, was arrested for having gay pornographic materials in his apartment. 4 decades later, the scandal became the basis of a nonfiction book. Now the story is getting a new telling, an operatic one, on the very college campus where the original events took place. New England Public Radio's Karen Brown reports.
Let's do just... About a dozen singers, professionals, and students sit in a theater at Amherst College as choral director Gregory Brown leads them through lyrics you don't often hear in opera.
1, 2, 3, and... Kinky, sneaky, commie, kinky, goodness.
They are rehearsing for the fall premiere of a new production, The Scarlet Professor, based on Barry Worth's book of the same name.
They've magically, I think, transformed this into a kind of a musical theater piece, very, very different from the treatment that I gave it, but in its bones, very close, I think, to the actual truth of the events.
Worth spent years researching the arrest of Smith College English professor Newton Arvin, who was an expert on Nathaniel Hawthorne's classic, The Scarlet Letter. On Labor Day weekend in 1960, Arvin's apartment was raided by the Massachusetts Police Anti-Smut Unit and the local postmaster, who found Beefcake magazines as well as Arvin's sexual journals.
This became known as the Smith College homosexual scandal of 1960. Internally, it was, this was years before Stonewall, this was something that was almost undiscussable at Smith. They referred to it as the affair.
The incident led to Arvin's public humiliation, his outing of two close colleagues as gay, the end of all their careers at Smith, and eventually, Worth says, two pivotal court decisions on obscenity and privacy, though too late to help Arvin.
In 1960, there was a purity binge in the United States. McCarthyism as a political movement was spent, but it was picked up with a kind of puritanical zeal by social conservatives.
After reading Worth's book, composer Eric Sawyer of Amherst College and lyricist Harley Erdman of the nearby University of Massachusetts decided to turn it into an opera. Like the book, the opera draws parallels between Arvin's public disgrace and that of Hawthorne's heroine, Hester Prynne, who was forced to wear the letter A on her dress for adultery.
And so did I, like Hawthorne before me, build my own dismal chamber.
The opera, which stars tenor Bill Hite, tells Arvin's story mostly through flashbacks and his imagination after he checks himself into the Northampton State Hospital for psychiatric treatment.
I can't go forward. I can't retreat.
I'm not drawn to art that deals with heroes.
Lyricist Harley Erdman.
I'm actually drawn to art of the people who are tormented, conflicted, unsuccessful, failing, and yet come to some kind of transformation where they can take action.
Composer Eric Sawyer admits he needed a little convincing to see Arvin as a compelling central character.
He was a victim, but he also was a difficult character to consider completely admirable because he named names. He named the names of his friends.
Now I turn 60. My life is over.
In the end, though, Sawyer connected with the complexity of Arvin's motives.
He had trouble liking himself. And that, I think, is sympathetic. I think it's something a lot of people can relate to.
Two and three. Tenor.
Newton Arvin was forced to retire his faculty position at Smith College after the scandal. His colleagues were fired. He wrote one more literary biography before he died 3 years later at 63. Opera director Ron Bashford.
Even though this was a very painful period for Arvin and he was outed against his will, ultimately it helped him become a more integrated, honest person. So he didn't live that much longer after all of this happened, but he did somehow manage to become, as he said, a person at peace with himself.
Love who you want to love. Love without fear, love without blame.
The opera will debut, fittingly, on the Smith College campus next month, along with a symposium about the Arvin case. Smith English professor Michael Thurston says no matter how far the college has come since 1960, from gay rights to free speech,
I think we are the product of our histories. There's no getting away from the fact that wherever we are around any issue in 2017, we got there through the actions of past actors, whether they were individuals or institutions.
And putting that history on stage, Thurston says, could help stop it from being repeated. For Here and Now, I'm Karen Brown.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakravarti.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.